The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Hey, this is Colin Coggins.
And this is Garrett Brown.
Authors of The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell.
And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where every Friday I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book. This show has been named one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, and has millions of downloads and listeners in over 185 countries. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, connect and message me on LinkedIn, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And to make sure you never miss an episode, you have a few options. The best way is to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, or go to marketingbookpodcast.com and sign up for email notifications. Or if you're on LinkedIn, find the Marketing Book Podcast page and click the subscribe button and maybe meet some of your fellow listeners. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Colin Coggins and Garrett Brown to talk about their book, The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell, published by Harper Business. Colin Coggins and Garrett Brown are longtime sales leaders, practitioners, teachers, and best friends. They met at software startup Bitium, which they helped lead to an acquisition by Google. They teach the popular course they created, Sales Mindset for Entrepreneurs, at the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business, home of the Fighting Trojans. They are also investors, corporate advisors, and co-founders of Agency 18, a firm that helps mission-driven companies adopt the unsold mindset. Sought after as keynote speakers and guest lecturers, they love connecting with audiences from diverse industries, professions, and backgrounds, and showing them that it's possible to successfully sell without being someone you're not. And, interesting fact, one of Colin's favorite songs is Party in the USA by Miley Cyrus. Yeah! And Garrett's favorite song is Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen. Hey, I just met you, and this is crazy, but here's my number, so call me maybe. Colin and Garrett, congratulations on The Unsold Mindset, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas.
Thanks for having
us. An intro unlike any other, and now that we've lost all of the UCLA fans, Notre Dame fans, and pop music fans, we can dig into some good stuff here.
Okay, well, you know, now I don't think you all are graduates of USC.
Oh, please, no, please, let me please do this before Garrett does it. Garrett is a fourth generation Trojan.
Oh, I'm sorry. How did I miss that?
No, it's amazing. I'm so happy you did this because, like, he always figures out a way to bring it up in any conversation.
Oh.
So the fact that you just said that is, like, makes me so happy that I got to say it before he did.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that sounds like University of Virginia graduates. But I digress. So, yeah, I interviewed some other authors who are USC grads. But wait a minute. There's other interesting facts. I mean, they don't end there with your favorite songs. Both of you were raised by amazing Jewish mothers, which I was very interested to see, and Garrett is an escaped lawyer. You went to law school, you practiced law for, what, about 5 minutes, and then you escaped. Is that about right?
That's about right, yeah. It was 3 years that felt like a life sentence. It was just not for me for a variety of reasons, but I was lucky enough at that time to have been representing startups and entrepreneurs. And so I kind of realized that it looked a little bit more fun on the other side of the table and got out while I still had a bit of my sanity left.
Ah, well, good for you. And I have actually interviewed a number of escaped lawyers, or they, as they call themselves, recovering lawyers. It's funny how many recovering lawyers and former engineers and mathematicians have written sales and marketing books.
Yeah, our friend Dan Pink, he says that he went to law school in a moment of youthful indiscretion. I always liked that way of putting it. But I know hundreds of lawyers, if not more, just because having gone to law school and practiced. And my dad was a lawyer. And I know exactly two that love it. So
that's something. I can remember reading that there are more law school graduates who are not practicing law than there are practicing law now. So somebody at the Wall Street Journal tracked that down. But wait a minute. Let's not leave Colin out of this. Right after college, Colin once sold fractional vacation ownership packages that were definitely not timeshares. Did I get that right, Colin?
You got that absolutely correct.
Okay. Now, I would like to announce that Colin and Garrett have said that any student of theirs at USC that mentions this interview gets an automatic A for the course. So really, thanks very much, guys. I appreciate you doing that. They do need to attend the lectures, though. So they do need to have perfect attendance. So longtime listeners will know that I generally interview just one author, which is fine with books with multiple authors, because it means that only one author has to endure the interview with me and put their reputation at risk. But you guys both wanted to be interviewed, and I thought that was really cool. So thank you for that. And dear listeners, this interview is two for the price of one. So on behalf of today's guests, I'd like to say you're welcome. Now, this is only the second interview out of nearly 500 that I've done with two authors at the same time. So I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone, and by that I mean I'm about to lose control, and I think I like it. I'm about to lose control, and I think I like it. So the question a lot of people have is, why is a book on sales on the Marketing Book Podcast? There's always a first-time listener to an episode, and the reason why is because marketers, and it's not just marketers that listen to this podcast, marketers who have a deep understanding of selling, the sales process, as well as the buying process, are always much more effective. And if you are a marketer and you are not working with your sales folks, spending time with your salespeople, you are at risk of being considered someone who works in the arts and crafts department. The make it pretty department, and that's just not going to be as good for your career. And there have been over 70 books on sales now on the Marketing Book Podcast. And I would like to mention, I get this request, I have a PDF that I can send anybody, which has a link to every interview. So I'll add this to it. And if anybody wants it, just let me know. So I want to read a quote from page 9. You write, "Whether or not you have sales in your job title, you'll see a piece of yourself in the unsold and gain valuable lessons from the way they think and approach life and sales. When we saw how powerful the effect of what we were teaching was for our class, our clients, and our audiences, we knew we had to write this book. There's a pressing need for all of us to enjoy selling and flourish in it. We all sell, after all. For those in traditional sales jobs, finding a healthier way to sell is critical. One study we found revealed that 2/3 of salespeople reported they were either close to or already experiencing burnout. People in sales are also particularly vulnerable to developing mental health issues like anxiety, depression, and addiction. So finding a way to sell more and be happier doing it isn't just a luxury, it's critical. For those who are not sales professionals by trade but are required to sell every day, which is pretty much everyone else, the anxiety caused by selling can be overwhelming, and reluctance towards selling can cause them to miss out on opportunities to become more successful, both personally and professionally. Our mission is to change the way people think about selling by changing the way they think about themselves. We know from experience that when selling is done the right way for the right reasons, it can affect real change. It can change circumstances, change thoughts, and change lives, all for the better. Call us naive, but we truly believe that if everyone approached selling with just a little more of an unsold mindset, the sales profession could shed its stereotype and be as respected as every other profession that serves others and contributes to society." So, guys, tell me, who are the unsold?
God, that's a deep question. And by the way, the book sounds so much better coming out of your voice than it does out of ours.
Well, thank you very much.
I just need to say that out loud. Garrett and I, you know, we went out on this mission and we thought we were writing a book about sales professionals and why they were great. And so we went out and we sought out, you know, some of the greatest sales professionals by trade out there. It's some of the biggest companies and startups and just all over. We're trying to find out what made them great. And we'd ask them two questions, you know, which was what makes you great and who's the greatest salesperson you know that has influenced you. And the entire book trajectory changed forever when this pattern emerged, which was all of these sales professionals were giving us names and titles of people that influenced them as the greatest salesperson that they knew without sales in their title. So like at some point, like we started seeing this as like an aha moment. Like, wait a minute, like why is it that all of these great sales professionals are influenced by people that are the exact opposite of who most people consider salespeople? And, you know, we'll dig into it later, but what we found was that the greatest salespeople on the planet are the exact opposite of who people think they are. Like they are absolutely unsold on who society expects them to be, what selling is supposed to look like, all the way down to what we expect customers want us to be, who they want us to be. And we found that there was this pattern and they just kept coming and coming. And every time we saw a pattern, we would see that all of these people that we were interviewing were doing the same exact thing. And they didn't even know it. And probably the beauty of it was they didn't know each other either. So like when you start going through the book, they're doing these amazing things and we hear it all the time. Like people are like, oh my God, that's what makes me great. I never knew I was doing it until you put a label on it.
Ah, interesting. Did you have some preconceived notions of what you were going to get when you asked those questions?
We definitely did. I mean, we came into this thing thinking, okay, here's probably what the chapters of the book are going to look like. But like Colin said, as soon as we started interviewing these people, we started to change our minds because it wasn't what we were expecting. And again, the reason we call them the unsold is because they were unsold on how it was supposed to be. So it makes sense that the answers they were giving us were unique. And a great example of it is, maybe skipping ahead to something you're going to want to talk about later, Douglas, but our final chapter in the book is about purpose. Mm-hmm. When we started writing that chapter, we thought we were writing a chapter about goals, because we figured that all of these successful people were really goal-oriented. We feel like we're goal-oriented. A lot of the people we know are. But as we would have conversations with them, they didn't want to talk about their goals, but they all wanted to talk about their purpose and why they were doing what they do and how they tie their goals to something bigger than just what they want to accomplish in a week or a month or a year. And so we definitely had our minds changed a bunch of times. And that was probably one of the most fun parts of the writing process, was figuring out that what we thought made people great at selling themselves and their ideas and their products and services was actually not quite what we expected.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, that chapter really got me thinking. And that's something I don't like to do, gentlemen, but I really appreciate that. And also, it's nominally about goals, but then you kick it up about 10 notches. And we'll talk about that. One of my favorite parts from the beginning of the book is you say the greatest salespeople aren't successful because of what they do. They're successful because of what they think. So let's jump into a couple it's really 9 big sections. And the first one is about authentic. And one of my favorite memes from the TV show 30 Rock is when the actor Steve Buscemi, if you guys have ever seen it, he's playing like a 50-year-old private detective, and he has to speak to some high school students for his investigation. So he sneaks into the school and tries to pass himself off as a fellow student. And he puts on like a baseball cap backwards and wears a cool t-shirt and puts a skateboard on his shoulder. And he walks up to the students and he says, "How do you do, fellow kids?" And that has become this meme for being the most inauthentic person you can possibly be. So on page 24, you write, if you show up as the opposite of who people expect a salesperson to be, something profound happens. And if you'll indulge me for just 2 minutes, it reminds me of this clip from Seinfeld where George Costanza decides to do the opposite of what he's always done.
"Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be. Every instinct I have in every aspect of life, be it something to wear, something to eat. It's often wrong. Everyone.
Tuna on toast, coleslaw, cup of coffee.
Yeah. No, wait a minute. I always have tuna on toast. Nothing's ever worked out for me with tuna on toast. I want the complete opposite of tuna on toast. Chicken salad on rye. Untoasted with a side of potato salad and a cup of tea.
Well, there's no telling what can happen from this.
You know, chicken salad's not the opposite of tuna. Salmon's the opposite of tuna, because salmon swim against the current and the tuna swim with it.
Good for the tuna.
George, you know that woman just looked at you.
So what? What am I supposed to do?
Go talk to her.
Elaine, bald men with no jobs and no money who live with their parents don't approach strange women.
Well, here's your chance to try the opposite. Instead of tuna salad and being intimidated by women, chicken salad and going right up to them.
Yeah, I should do the opposite. I should.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Yes, I will do the opposite. I used to sit here and do nothing and regret it for the rest of the day. So now I will do the opposite and I will do something. Excuse me, I couldn't help but notice that you were looking in my direction.
Oh, yes, I was. You just ordered the same exact lunch as me.
My name is George. I'm unemployed and I live with my parents.
I'm Victoria. Hi.
So on page 14, you write, it sounds so simple, be authentic, but it's said a lot and practiced much less, especially when people sell. So, Colin, when you were right out of college selling fractional vacation ownership packages that were definitely not timeshares, tell us what happened to you.
It's funny. We joke about it, but a lot of what, you know, we talk about and most of the impact that we've seen, a lot of it starts from these days in timeshare, right? Because the thing about timeshare is that, like, I also felt like I was better than like these timeshare salespeople. I was fresh out of college. I could tell you every reason why I was so bad at selling in my first 2 months on this job. But like, I was horrible. I would say I was smarter, or I would say I was too young, or I stood on higher moral ground. But the reality was, fresh out of college, first job, or I had to move back in with my parents. So I took the timeshare job. I mean, fractional ownership.
Thank you.
And I was really, really bad at it. And it, on the third month.
Now, wait a minute. They were telling you probably exactly what to say and how to do it, right? Just like a boiler room.
I had everything I needed to be successful. Mm-hmm. I had the script. I had the dress code. I had the demeanor. And I just couldn't do it. Like, I was just terrible. So on my third month, they put me on something called a PIP. And I hope no one on this podcast knows what that stands for. But for the few of you that do, it's a performance improvement plan. It just means like, yo, I'm going to get fired. So on the third month, I did what I thought that any, you know, freshly graduated, 21-year-old who's about to get fired from his first job does. I tried to screw over the establishment on my way out. So, like, it was as simple as that. Like, it was a beautiful accident. So, like, on my third month, I stopped abiding by the dress code. I stopped asking questions I didn't want to know the answers to. I stopped laughing at jokes that weren't funny. Like, very weird stuff. And this was the month that I accidentally broke the sales record. I mean, and it was incredible because it was this weird moment when it was so obvious in hindsight. Like, the minute that I stopped acting like the person that they expected me to be was the moment that they started treating me like a human being. And then I started to see myself in them. And that was the moment that I realized this whole sales thing is about, like, how quickly you can get someone to realize that they can see themselves in you, or you can see yourself in them. So, like, timeshare taught me, you know, over those next 6 years, like, they gave me so many people to train how to basically be the opposite of good salespeople, because it worked. And, you know, everything from I mean, everything from asking questions that you really wanted to know the answers to. I remember this one question in timeshare, and it was so powerful. I was watching it. I was on a table. I was a manager. And this person, you could tell that they just saw themselves in the client. Like these two people, like they barely take their kids on vacation. Like, I don't know who this salesperson saw, like in himself across the table, but it was either the dad or the son. And he goes, hey, what did you get for your first birthday? Because he didn't remember like his own first birthday present. So we asked this question, and this dad, you know, you see him, he goes, I have no idea. And he goes, do you remember like where you went for your first vacation? And you just see the dad's eyes like light up and like tell this story about like when he was 3 years old, like going to Disneyland. And then the kid's like, yeah, like I ask myself these questions all the time. It's like why I work here. Like I'm trying to understand why you remember your first vacation, but you don't remember your first present. And you see this dad for the first time talk about how important it is to like spend time with the people he cares most about on something that like is not tangible, that he'll never ever see again. And it was the day I was like sold on timeshare, where I was like, this guy's about to buy, not because of some ROI, but because it's going to force him to do what's most important to him every single year. Mm-hmm. Because the guy literally said it, like, I will not spend thousands of dollars on something that I will never see again. So, you know, really timeshare opened up my world to this idea that you could share pieces of yourself that most people teach you to hide, and you'll get credit for it.
Mm. Well, Garrett, how do people fail at trying to be authentic, other than what Steve Buscemi did when he said, hello, fellow young people?
Yeah, we talk to so many students about this because, you know, they're almost scared. They think, I'm about to go out into the real world and have my first real job. And you know, what if I get laughed at, or what if I get judged because I do something? And so people fail in it a bunch of different ways. One is just, you know, you think you're giving yourself permission to say the quiet part out loud, to talk about the things that people teach you to hide. But in reality, you haven't convinced yourself, you know, to necessarily do that yet. And then the other thing is people will go too far. And we talk a little bit in the book about, and we talk a lot in our speaking events and our classes about the boundaries of authenticity. Because there are certain things in certain professions that you just can't do. And so when we're talking about being authentic, we're certainly talking about it within the boundaries of your career, your role, your industry. And, you know, there's a story in the book about the MSNBC anchor, Ari Melber. And he is, for those who don't know him, he's kind of become famous for reading hip hop lyrics during the news. Like, he's a huge hip hop fan. So he might be doing a story on, you know, economics and quoting a Jay-Z quote. And we were talking to him, and he said, you know, if I was being my most authentic self, I would show up on the air and I'd be wearing Nikes and a hoodie. But the reality is I can't do that because people wouldn't take me seriously. My message would get lost. And it just wouldn't be professional. So there are boundaries to how authentic I can be. So for him, he found a way to weave in things that are authentic to his personality, lyrics that are relevant to a news story, for example, while still realizing that you can go too far, the same way that Steve Buscemi maybe went a little bit too far by trying to pretend that he was something he wasn't.
Right. And I think the sin there is he just had very little self-awareness, which I think is a big part of being authentic. It's interesting, on page 22, you write, if you ask us, the reason only about 20% of salespeople hit their numbers is because the 80% are trying to be like the 20%, while the 20% aren't trying to be like anyone beside themselves. Why did you all choose authenticity as the topic for this first of 9 big chapters?
Yeah, I don't know if we chose it as much as it just became the reality as we had these conversations. Like, it is absolutely the umbrella top of theme that covers everything else. Because, again, these unsold aren't doing things the way they're supposed to. They're not trying to fit into the box of a marketer or a salesperson or a parent or anything else. They're doing things their own way and realizing that what works for some people won't work for others. So that quote that you just gave is a perfect example. You know, we've already mentioned scripts to a certain extent when Colin was talking about his fractional ownership experience. And a lot of times, young sellers, young marketers, even who have, you know, who are doing email campaigns, they've got the script, they've got the email written out for them. And it's like, this is what you do. But the problem is, what sounds good coming out of my mouth would not sound good coming out of Colin's mouth, and vice versa. And that's true for anyone. And so it's really about, like, how do you come across as the version of yourself that's going to sound the most confident, that's going to be able to communicate the most clearly, and that's the most genuinely interested in the people that you're trying to serve.
Just a double down on this. Like, authenticity is the through line, because it's the biggest, most obvious characteristic trait that we saw in all of them. And it's so hard to tell someone to be authentic. So, like, through the book, what you're seeing is, like, tactical ways that you can create an infrastructure to mitigate inauthenticity. Because when you tell someone to be authentic, like, we were interviewing Chef Roy Choi, and we were like, tell us about, you know, your authentic self. And he was like, which one? And it's such a beautiful question. Like, is it me as a father or a son or a restaurateur or an entrepreneur or an introvert? Like, and so through the book, you start to see how people can be authentic as opposed to just saying the word, you know. Mm-hmm. As I think one of the biggest epiphanies for Garrett and I in this authenticity journey was when we started noticing that people were talking to themselves out loud.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
They were saying the quiet part out loud. In the book, we call it showing your work, like in math class, right? Like, you didn't get credit for just the answer. You got credit for the left side of the equal sign and really, like, showing how you got there. Like, we were interviewing people and they would introduce themselves, you know, like, hey, my name is Jason, this is my title. And then they'd stop, like, in the middle of their introduction. They'd look up at the ceiling and they'd be like, why do I keep doing that? And they look back down at us, just like that. They look back down at us and then say, can I start over again? And, like, we saw it almost in every interview. We were interviewing the number one top trial lawyer. The guy did the same exact thing. We were like, tell us about, like, a great selling moment in the courtroom. He's like, well, I remember this one time when the judge asked me to repeat what I said, and I definitely didn't remember. And I looked up at the ceiling and I just said it out loud. I was like, what did I just say? And I looked back at the judge and the jury and I said, Your Honor, I have no idea. And the jury erupts laughter. And it's like, authenticity is so interesting because, like, these are stories about people that are figuring out a way to, like, create commonality with people. Mm-hmm. They're not doing it on purpose, but, like, listen, like, people like buying from people like themselves. So really, like, we're talking about, how do you relate to someone? Like, the only true way to do it is, like, we'll go to the common denominator, which is we're both imperfect. And while some people would view this authenticity and vulnerability as something that we've been taught to hide for so long in our professional careers, what we were starting to find was that, unintentionally or not, this was their superpower, this permission they were giving themselves to be authentic. So I think that authenticity had to be number one because it just seems to come up in every chapter.
Oh, yeah. And it goes way beyond just selling. I think, you know, career success, but it really is the substrate for the entire book, and particularly, like, the very next one, which is intentional ignorance. Now, I am, as many listeners will tell you, exceptionally ignorant, and like Forrest Gump,
I'm not a smart man.
But now, because of your book, henceforth, I shall be able to claim that I am being intentionally ignorant, which is, you know, the second of these nine principles. And for that, I will be eternally grateful to you, gentlemen. And on page 44, you write, the irony of believing we must know everything as a salesperson, or at least give the impression we do, is that it can lead us into traps that undermine the impressions we make and the quality of our relationships with those we're selling to. So, Garrett, when selling, what are the advantages, believe it or not, of not having all the answers at the tip of your tongue?
You know how different you sound when you're talking to somebody about something that you are genuinely passionate about, genuinely excited about, or genuinely just know a lot about. and are knowledgeable about, versus the conversations that you have maybe in a work setting where you just have to have the conversation and you kind of care about this, but not really. Like you come across completely differently. So we found multiple instances in the conversations that we were having with great sellers, with and without sales in their title, where they realized that and they just said, you know what, I'm going to set up an infrastructure around myself to make sure that I'm always showing up as the best version of myself. So, you know, a great example is we were talking to a woman who sells advertising technology. And she said, you know what, there came a point in my career where I realized I don't actually like technology. And we go, what? I mean, you sell technology and you're really good at it. She goes, yeah, I realized that when it comes to technology, I don't get excited talking about API integrations and things like that. I love my clients and I love helping them solve the problems and do the things that our products can help them do. But I don't necessarily like talking about technology. And she said her entire career changed one day where instead of pretending that she had the answers and reading from the script, somebody asked her a question about technology that she didn't have the answer to. And she said, I don't know, but I will find out the answer. Let's go find out the answer together.
Yes.
And so from that moment on, she realized that she was getting rewarded for being resourceful and for being able to go out there and be on the team of her customers to go find answers to things that she just didn't care about. So she didn't have to sound like she did, like she wasn't in, you know, like she wasn't excited about something. And then, you know, we started seeing that all over the place. We were talking to General Stanley McChrystal, who some people listening may remember. He ran the joint forces in Afghanistan, which I believe means he was responsible for tens of thousands of soldiers across, I think, 48 countries. Really important stuff. And he said, you know, people expect me as a general to walk into the room and know everything and start barking orders and say, you do this and you go there. And he said, when it came to my missions, I didn't want to know everything because one, it would have taken too much time away from the things I'm good at to get up to speed. And two, there are people in the organization whose job it is and whose life passion it is to know about certain details. And he didn't want to strip them of that. So he realized that if he could stay intentionally ignorant about the things that, again, he wasn't the strongest at or didn't know the most about, he had that infrastructure around him. And so we always, you know, when we talk to companies or when we do keynotes, we always point out that it is absolutely possible to create that infrastructure in your own role, whatever it is. Like if you're not passionate about something, if you don't know a lot about something, is there somebody in your organization who does know a lot about it, whose job it is to do that thing all day? Or are there customers that you can bring in or other resources so that you can empower yourself to show up as the absolute best version of yourself as often as you possibly can?
Yeah, I can remember, you guys have probably heard of David Sandler and the Sandler Sales Training Organization. And there was, I'm hearing a talk he had given. He told a story along these lines about somebody who had just started at a store and some customers were coming in saying, I need to buy this space heater. Can you help me figure out which one? And apparently he said, I just started. I'm not sure, but let's go take a look at the boxes and see if we can figure it out together. And apparently he sold a lot of heaters. And then once he had more knowledge about them, he sold fewer and fewer because he was kind of giving the impression that the customers didn't have the agency. He was almost perhaps coming across as almost too slick.
Yeah, it's such an interesting observation because we talk a lot about, you know, the old sales adage, if you ask for advice, you get money. And if you ask for money, you get advice. And so, you know, we were interviewing medical sales reps and they were telling us that, you know, in the medical industry, like sometimes like their training is like they'll train you for a week and then they'll throw you into the hospital if you're like a medical supply rep. And the reason they do it earlier than they're ready for it is because they have no choice but to go to the doctors, go to the end users and ask them questions and ask them why and like advice on how. And it was just this incredible thing. And he said, you know, there's a big drop off of medical sales reps on year two. And we said, why is that? And he said, well, because they have all the answers. Right. So they stop asking for advice. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, look, intentional ignorance is, you know, listen, we teach a class on mindset, right? Like we had a choice to make. We taught the sales mindset for entrepreneurs at USC, seeing in the workforce that we were in, Like all the new entrants, like didn't know how to follow their own dreams. They didn't know how to ask for permission. They didn't know how to ask for what they wanted. They didn't know how to create relationships, communicate across the organization. Like they didn't know how to move people. And so they weren't able to change their world or anybody else. We started teaching this class. We were like, we're going to focus on mindset because that's actually what makes great salespeople great. Not what they do, but how they think. You know, we interviewed a like number one person at every place he's ever been at. They say he sells the unsellable. And we're like, tell us about your process. And he goes, I don't really have one. You know, they give me a lead. I don't look at like, you know, I have a little conversation with myself. I get pumped up and I go to the demo. And Garrett and I pause and we look at each other and we go, you don't look at the data? And he laughs. He's like, no. Like, why wouldn't you look at the firmographic information the company pays for to help you sell better? And, you know, it was just some long drawn out conversation about like, why would I? Like, I know the propensity of like, who's going to buy in Southwest versus Northeast. So what happens if I know that I'm talking to someone in the Southwest? I'm going to show up differently. So like, you know, he was not eloquent in saying that I am intentionally ignorant to the firmographic data that my company gives me and self-aware enough to know that I'm going to treat them differently. So I'd like to show up and give them the best version of myself. But that's exactly what they were all doing in like very different capacities. They were just intentionally ignorant. And there's a listen. I know I'm long-witted, so I'm gonna stop really soon. But
it's okay. I bought a lot of extra audio tape at Costco today.
The thing that we don't talk enough about with the intentional ignorance chapter is like the byproduct of being intentionally ignorant to the things that you don't authentically love is that you have to also acknowledge the parts of your job that you love so much. You know, you'd basically be solving the problem for free. You know, Ray Lewis has the ex-football player, he's got this quote, it's one of my favorite quotes. And he says, they pay me for what I do Monday to Saturday, but Sundays are free. And he loves the game so much, he play for free on Sundays, but like they're paying him for the bodily injury and all that, and, you know, and being away from his kids. And so like when you look at intentionally ignorant, you can't be intentionally ignorant to the things that don't bring you energy if you're not first acknowledging the things that do bring you energy. And that was something that like was very obvious with the people that we were talking to, what they authentically loved about what they did every day.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to jump over to another chapter, which was very interestingly titled Pathological Optimism. I want to read from page 91. You write, in our conversations with people who love selling, we discovered that they have an almost supernatural ability to look for the good, even in the most challenging situations. We get that this might seem like we're simply putting our own spin on the all too familiar and sometimes condescending cliches, look on the bright side, or turn lemons into lemonade. There's been pushback against such simplistic takes on optimism, with good reason. Talk about what toxic positivity is, because that's not what you all are talking about.
Yeah, toxic positivity has gotten a little bit of buzz in the media in recent years. And it's basically where people just tell you, hey, look on the bright side, everything's going to be great, without acknowledging the fact that there are very real challenges. And when somebody is feeling something that maybe is not the most optimistic or the most positive, there's probably often a good reason behind that. So for us, we wanted to be really conscious of that as we wrote this chapter, because it did become very clear in our interviews that all of these unsold people that we were talking to were very optimistic. Like you would absolutely mark them down as optimists on the optimism scale. But they were also very realistic in the sense that they know that they and everyone else will have bad days, bad quarters, bad years, sometimes really bad. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that you're not an optimist. Like if you are having if you're in the middle of a tough situation at work or otherwise, you know, it's okay to sit in that and acknowledge that and realize that that's having some kind of impact. But what all of these people did have in common was that over time, they knew that things would be up and to the right, that things would work out, that they would close the deal. And when it came to selling specifically, you know, they also realized, and this will be a common theme with almost everything we talk about, they also realize that they sound different if they're talking to someone that they know is going to buy from them. So instead of coming in and going, oh, I only close 2 out of every 10 deals, so I've got a 20% chance of closing this one. they're going to go out and they're going to have a conversation and treat that person like they're already a customer. Because you can't hate a person who's giving you money, who's putting food on your table, who's putting your kids through college or paying for your vacation. They know they're going to sound different. So there's that level of optimism as well, without glossing over the fact that not every day is rainbows and sunshine.
Are there things that can be done to make you more pathologically optimistic?
There are a lot of things to be done. The big one, the one that we love to preach the most, and if you sat in on our class for 16 weeks, our students probably roll their eyes behind our backs because we say it so much, but we talk about celebrating the process. And this is different than trust the process, which you'll see a lot online and in other books. This is literally celebrating the process, not just celebrating the wins, because especially in sales, and marketers are definitely part of that sales world. If you're just waiting for the closed deals in an enterprise sale, you could be waiting a really long time. And that's a lot of delayed gratification. And that's where burnout comes and the frustration comes. But if you can learn to celebrate not just those wins, but everything in between, if you can learn to celebrate the lesson that you learned when you got hung up on yesterday, or when your deal fell through right at the end of the quarter, the one that you thought was going to make your quarter, and then all of a sudden it fell through at the end. If you can celebrate those, knowing that, hey, I've learned a lesson here. Here's what I'm not going to do next time I'm in that situation, or here's why I'm now better at XYZ. If you can get really good at that, then suddenly selling, marketing becomes a game of prolonged gratification. That's a lot more fun to play. And that's the kind of optimism that we saw amongst the people we were talking to. They would realize, hey, you know, this happened, but here's why it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Then a chapter before that, you all talk about the six most powerful words in sales. What could I have done differently? That was terrific. Well, let me just draw this distinction, because I think this one is also misunderstood to a certain extent, and that's about gratitude, where on page 106, you write, gratitude is having a pretty big moment these days, so much so that we almost didn't include it at the risk of sounding too much like everyone else. But the more we thought about it, the more we realized we'd be remiss if we didn't discuss it. Talk about why gratitude is the single most important sales activity that contributes to this sustained optimism.
We titled the book The Unsold Mindset, because the conversations that you have with yourself are typically way more important than the conversations that you're having with other people when you're selling. And a lot of times in our world, people enter our world through this professional development, and they exit through a personal development lens, only because if everyone's selling themselves or an idea or somebody else's idea, like, then we're always selling something. And it's not this like yucky word if you're doing it, you know, in your own authentic way. So the question is, like, are we talking about selling authentically or living authentically? And that is really at the crux of this gratitude thing, because there are just people in this world that think that they have to do something. And then there are people in this world that think that they get to do something. And the people that we were interviewing were so stoked that they got to ask questions from people that they would have never met. Like, they were looking at phone calls as an opportunity to learn. Mm-hmm. Like, there's this concept that we talk about in the book about being a knower versus a learner.
Right.
Because if everybody's reading, right, if everyone's reading the same books and everyone's consuming the same content, the same TED Talks, the same podcasts, why is it that at any given, you know, firm, you've got 20% of people that are thriving and 80% of people trying to figure it out? And it has to do with how they consume information. And so, you know, we couldn't ignore it when every time we would talk to someone, you could tell that they were just so grateful that they got to do this. And selling, like, if it's true, which we believe it is, if everyone is selling themselves or their ideas or somebody else's ideas, then we're always doing it. Like, these, we're talking about opportunities. Here's a clearer way to say it. When we start every keynote, we ask two questions. Right? The first question is, like, what do you think of when you hear the word salesperson? And everybody goes, yucky, manipulative, smarmy, et cetera.
Always be closing.
Yeah, exactly. And then we ask, who's the greatest salesperson you can think of? And, like, the answers would amaze you. The top two answers out of thousands of people is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Steve Jobs. Mm-hmm. And a close third are, like, people's kids or people's partners. So, you know, if everyone like is looking at these great sellers because they're not just selling products and services, but they're moving people and they're selling ideas, then like you could root this sort of gratitude in all of the selling that you do. And that's what we were finding. They weren't grateful sellers. They were grateful people. So they had grateful thoughts. And the act of selling was rooted in who they were, like as great, as grateful minded people, not as like grateful salespeople. That was a lot. I hope that made sense.
Yeah. I want to jump to page 143, where you talk about, you know, basically selling, you know, on the same side of the table. And you write, those selling with an unsold mindset aren't adversarial about selling. They're not looking to find a weak spot in an opponent's defenses to exploit. They approach conversations with a same team mentality in which they see themselves in alignment with prospects working together toward a common goal. Their job is to support prospects, have their back, and ultimately do right by them. They don't see sales as a zero-sum game. If something isn't good for a prospect, then it isn't good for them. And then on page 150, you write that you don't teach people to have empathy. You teach people to give empathy. Explain the difference there, Garrett.
Yeah, empathy is one of those things that's really overused and sometimes misunderstood. Like most people, when you think of empathy, you think, okay, I'm gonna put myself in the other person's shoes and like try to understand what they're feeling. But we try to teach people to focus on the byproduct of empathy, which is that the other person feels understood. And that's a gift. That's giving empathy, right? If somebody, it's one thing to try to go, oh, I understand what my customer's feeling. And so now that I understand that, here's how I'm going to sell them, versus I am genuinely interested in what they have to say. I am genuinely interested in solving the problem that I can help them solve. And I want them to know that and feel that. So that's the gift. That's giving empathy right there. And just to kind of go back to the first quote that you just read, I think that goes to something a lot bigger than just selling. I mean, so many people are so transactional in their interactions with other people. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm going to do this for you, and then you're going to do that for me. Not just in selling, but in life. And this was one of the later chapters to take form, because we started to go back and watch all these interviews we were doing. And we hadn't really figured out how to label it yet. But what all of these people were doing, the mindset that they had in their interactions with other people, was that they wanted to be transformational, yeah, not transactional. And it wasn't about like, what can you do for me right now? And then I can move on to the next one. It was like, how is this? How can I build a genuine relationship? How can I change your business? Even maybe if it doesn't have to do with the thing that I'm trying to sell you necessarily. And so that mindset of being transformational versus transactional is something that I think you can consciously make the shift on. And it can be a huge game changer in terms of your interactions with other people.
Yeah, it's so true. And like so many of the chapters in your book, I can think of like individual books that tackle just that chapter or half of the chapter you have there. And there was a book by yet another recovering lawyer called The Transformational Consumer. It was a few years ago. I interviewed her. And she explained how the more that you can start to zero in on the transformation somebody is seeking to attain, in other words, they're not just trying to buy a screwdriver or a drill or, you know, a roofing job, there's a bigger transformation, largely emotional, that they're trying to attain. And that's why I liked that so much. And also, of course, for all the marketers listening, it applies to so much of the marketing content. Rather than selling the product, you're actually trying to help somebody with a transformation, even if it's a pack of gum. If somebody buys at the convenience store, they want to have better breath. Well, why do they want to have better breath? You know, on and on and on. Related to that chapter on transform, don't transact, can you explain what impactful questions are, the way you all frame it?
I was just thinking as you were talking about that, about impactful questions. And it's actually rooted in the gratitude conversation you were having and the authenticity conversation that we've been having. You know, most of us extract value when we ask questions. Like it's just human nature. It's like, tell me, show me, give me. Like those are, most of us are extracting value in some way when we're asking questions.
Yeah, and I would add that a bad salesperson doing a discovery call. It's more often like one of the depositions that Garrett might have sat in on when he was practicing law.
Yeah, I mean, even great salespeople, like it's still a take.
Yeah.
So it's because it's such a hard thing to do, right? Like, how do you add value by asking questions? And that's what we found that fascinating, that there's this rare breed of people that have figured out a way to add value by asking questions. And they've always said it. Great salespeople are remembered for their questions and not their statements. But like, how? Like, how is it that these people, because they even did it to us, like these people are asking questions that most people don't want to know the answers to. And so when you ask questions that, you know, most people have never heard before, you know, you're allowing someone to ideate for the first time in real time on that answer because they've never thought about it before. Now, that's a gift. Like, if you never see me again, just the question that I asked, right, the original thought that you were forming because I cared about something that most people didn't. If I never saw you again, like you would, like that's yours. Like, you bought that answer. You weren't sold that answer. And that's that sense of agency that runs through the book. Is like, a lot of times people will say no to you because you're right. You know, but like, for people to feel like they are part of the decision-making process, to feel like they have ownership in the answers, like, you watch people ask impactful questions and you see it. And the problem with impactful questions and why there's other chapters that are dedicated to this is that you can't weaponize this. Just like anything in the book, like you can't ask a leading question. You can't ask a question to someone that you know the answer to that you don't think that they do. Like, we smell that a mile away.
Yes, yes.
Like, the reason why the reason why these people are asking questions that are so impactful that most people don't want to know is because they want to know different things, right, than most people. And that has to do a lot more with how they view the person. Like, the brain is really malleable. It'll find what it's looking for. Are you looking for the good in a person? Or are you looking for the bad in the person? Like, how are you researching the person? Like, what do you want? Yeah, there's a story in the book about this guy who, like, we gave him a lead and he didn't want to and he didn't want to take the lead for whatever reason. We were like, we want you to do this exercise. We want you to fall in love with the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was like the number one hitter in the room. He like almost laughed us out the room. He was like, dude, he was like, I'm not falling in love with someone. We were like, look, like, long story long, just take the lead. Okay. And we're going to give you 3 minutes, find three things that you could love about the person. And then, you know, through trials and tribulations, he said, yes, the clock starts, he's typing away. And about, you know, 60 seconds in, you hear it. He goes, huh. He's like on LinkedIn researching the lead. And we're like, what? And he's like, this guy graduated college around the same time I did. And Garrett and I look at each other. We're like, and you love people the same age as you? And he's like, no, I don't love people the same age as me. He starts typing again. And then you hear it. He goes, huh. And we go, what? And he goes, this guy graduated from the University of Minnesota. And before we could even ask him, he's like, no, I don't love the University of Minnesota. And so we don't get it, right? We're like, what's happening here? But something's happening. And the whole sales room is like watching him do this. And then eventually he looks up at us and he goes, but I do love Bob Dylan.
Oh, yes. Go,
okay. And he goes, and Bob Dylan is my age and went to the University of Minnesota. And so, like, this wasn't even a qualified lead, so we were going to give it to, like, a rookie because the point was made. And the guy goes, no, no, no. There's no way I didn't just spend 3 minutes falling in love, right, like shaking his head, right, not to see if it's the real deal. And so the whole team saw it. Like, he was going to show up to that demo and ask questions that nobody else was going to ask. And that's exactly what he did. He showed up on the demo, and the first thing that guy did was he goes, Dylan? You know, and the guy, like, was like, huh? He was like, Bob Dylan? Like, and you've never seen a more, like, unattractive bro fest for like 45 minutes. Like, these guys caught such a vibe. The guy bought. The guy was an unqualified lead. Like, he wasn't even qualified to purchase, and he purchased. So anyways, we could go on for hours on impactful questions, but, you know, it's about the sense of agency that you talked about. It's about why you're asking questions. And I think that's more important than the questions themselves sometimes.
Yeah. And there's a whole chapter on, fall in love, and you guys write about how it's nearly impossible to interact with someone and not find something to love about them. It's great. The thing about the questions, which are just so unbelievably powerful, is you all quoted Mark Roberge, who is the author of the Sales Acceleration Formula. He was on the podcast several years ago, and he was like HubSpot, like the fourth employee there, and he became head of sales, and he had never been a salesperson, but he had a mechanical engineering degree and an MBA from MIT. And he was talking about how the best salespeople he ever interacted with are masters at asking questions that lead buyers to new understandings. At the end of a call, buyers might say, "I feel like I'm in therapy." And you write that he said, "All a therapist does is ask a bunch of questions that reframe your world. Great salespeople do the same thing." So I want to jump over to just two other things before we wrap up. One of them is about creativity. And when you all ask people to name the top characteristics of a great salesperson, you write that creativity rarely, if ever, makes the list. So I guess let's throw it back to Garrett. Why is that, do you think? And why should creativity really be at the forefront of sales success?
I think it goes back to the stereotypes that we tried to shatter with this book in the first place, which is that the perfect salesperson is well-rehearsed and buttoned up and knows all the answers and does things a certain way, so that if you have this objection, they're going to overcome it that way. You feel like there's not that there's really strict boundaries on what it means to sell.
You want to work here, close.
So all these great sellers, though, when you think about why they're so different, why they're so unique, why people are excited to interact with them, it's because they're creative. It's because they're not doing things the way they're supposed to be done, but instead they're always thinking, how can I do things a different way? How can I leverage the technology that my company provides in a different way? And I think this will be really relevant to the marketers as well. And marketing has a bit more of a creative stereotype to it, because there is creative involved oftentimes. And but you know, you have these tools that you use. You have your email tools and your drip campaign tools and everything else. How can you leverage those differently than everybody else? Or how can you do something that's unique and on brand and comfortable for you to go out and get somebody's attention so that they can learn about what you're doing? And it was fun to see some of the different ways that people did it, whether or not it had to do with their product or their service or not. The most creative folks that we saw ended up A, having more fun, and B, getting better results.
Yes, I thought one of my favorite paragraphs was from 193, where you write, "People love to label sales as scientific and data-driven, pointing to statistics and formulas as the reason for their success and LinkedIn influencer stardom." "You've got to make 50 calls a day, according to one post, and seek to spend an average of 9.6 minutes on every call." That's awfully precise and absurd. Characterizing advice like that as scientific is an insult to science, which is one of the most creative endeavors you can undertake. Science requires experimenting with things that have never been tried before, testing new ideas, even if they seem crazy, rejecting conventional wisdom, and constantly asking, what if? And why not? Einstein said, the greatest scientists are always artists as well. So you touched on the last one about goals and purpose earlier when we were in our conversation. I wanted to wrap up with that. And one of your favorite things to do when you're speaking to a group of salespeople is to ask, how many of you have goals? And you go on to write that virtually every hand in the room will go up. What then do you follow up with after they've all raised their hand and said, oh yeah, we all have goals?
So everyone's hands go up, and then we ask them what, only keep your hands up if in addition to having goals, you look at them somewhere every day. And then about half the hands go down, but there's still like a proud cohort in the room with their hands up. And then we go, okay, and with the hands that are up, left up, how many of you have a purpose that is articulated and written somewhere that you look at often? And typically every hand goes down in the room. And if we were in a room of 3,000 people in Nashville and there were three hands up, there's always about three hands up, no matter how many people. And it's just like we were alluding to it earlier. This was not on purpose, this chapter. Like, we were out there trying to find how people that were successful were viewing goals, and they just kept shoehorning the word purpose in. And when they were talking about goals, they were talking about them in a light that we really weren't familiar with. Like, we were getting asked questions like, have you ever hit a goal and then thought to yourself, damn, I wish that this felt different? Like, have you ever hit a goal and thought to yourself, wait, this is it? Right? He was like, you know, the thing about goals in this one interview is just that you think that it's this finish line, but it's not. And so the more and more that we started interviewing people, we found out that, like, they were not looking at goals as finish lines. They were looking at goals as mile markers. Like, they were manufacturing, unintentionally most of the time, a way to be in the best part of the movie, a way to be in the chase. So, like, their goals were their mile markers, but they had this purpose that was their finish line. And, like, you know, these purposes, like, these are words, ing words, serving, you know, like, living, teaching, inspiring. Like, you don't wake up one day and just get it and go, okay, done inspiring, right? Like, so they were attaching their goals to their purpose, which meant that when they achieved them, they hit a mile marker and they were able to say that I'm that much closer to my purpose. But it wasn't what most of us do when we hit a goal, which is think to ourselves, damn, I thought this was going to feel differently. And the other thing I'll say about goals is the downside of goals is, like, we don't wake up one day and decide to be yucky, smarmy, horrible people, right? Like, we don't wake up one day and say, I want to be a yucky salesperson.
You close or you hit the bricks.
Right. That's not what happens. Like, typically you have a goal over your head and you're not hitting it. And your back's against the wall and you're resorting to unnatural acts. And you see that, you know, everybody's selling. So you know that you can do that in any capacity. So we really just found that these goal-oriented people were such they were such pillars. They were like weather. Like, they would come in the room and everyone would change because they would treat people differently because they saw their purpose in them. You know, like, I don't know you that well, Douglas, but, like, you are important to me because you are helping me serve my purpose. I move differently. And so these people all had a purpose defined so that they were able to see their purpose, not just in what they were doing, but who they were doing it with. And that was just that was a shock to the system for us and really changed how we viewed goals forever.
There are still a lot of companies that, it's my sense, give goals to their sales team, something like this.
As we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest, as you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
I gather you still meet business owners or maybe CEOs who are kind of not in touch with what the salespeople are doing. What is a purpose-driven goal? Can you say more about that? Because you started to touch on it, like teaching or serving, things like that. And now in the book, you write that knowing your purpose is easier said than done. And you have quite a bit on, you know, the ways that you can start to get closer to your actual purpose. What would be examples of some of the purpose-driven goals you've seen or helped clients reveal to themselves?
You touched on something really important, which is in order to have purpose-driven goals, you certainly have to do the work to define and articulate your purpose. And as you say, there's a lot of different ways to do that. We have a quick and dirty one in the book. You don't even have to buy our book to do it. You can go online and find a way to do it. But the very first step is get out there and figure out what is it that you're doing or why is it that you're doing the things you do. And for some people, it's going to be a long drawn out process to try to figure it out. And for others, it's going to be really simple and that's okay. But once you have that, then the next step for setting purpose-driven goals is to take that purpose and tie it to the goals that you already have for yourself or the ones that you are setting for yourself. So you might have a simple goal of like, my goal is to make X amount of revenue this quarter. And that's a great goal. But as Colin mentioned earlier, the downside of that is, you know, what happens towards the end of the quarter when you're not going to hit it, when you're falling short, do you start to act unnaturally and become that salesperson that you don't want to be? Or you do hit it and it's like, okay, what now? I get to set another goal and that's it. So to make that goal purpose-driven, instead of just saying my goal is to make X amount of revenue this quarter, you add the back half of that equation, which is my goal is to make X amount of revenue this quarter because, blank, or so I can blank. And that blank is filled in with something related to your purpose. And we found that by doing that with the goals that you have for yourself on any given day, it allows you to more easily turn those goals into the mile markers that Colin was talking about, as opposed to the finish lines that we all kind of realize they aren't actually. So having that purpose attached to the goals to see, okay, how does this goal get me closer to what I'm really trying to do and why I'm trying to do it, is extremely motivating, extremely inspirational, and also just changes things when maybe you're falling short, because you realize that even though you're falling short of the goal, you're still making progress towards that bigger purpose.
Right. You're right. If we set purpose-driven goals, they can motivate us and provide the fulfillment we're all looking for. You know, it just seemed to me like if someone were to only read one chapter, which no one does, but this one chapter, it could really open their mind up to some big possibilities. And then, of course, I had to laugh when you quoted comedian J.B. Smoove, who said, "My purpose in the end," this is a comedian, "my purpose in the end is to make people happy and to make them laugh and to give them great memories." Okay, so there's obviously a bunch of quantitative things that go with that. But I could see how that would be helpful if maybe he's not getting quite as many gigs he wanted in that particular time period, that sort of thing.
Douglas, you laughed when you read JB's quote there. He had us laughing for a good solid hour. And you know, his vocabulary is very colorful. So most of the stuff would not be appropriate to quote on a podcast or anywhere else. But he is, he's a great example of these unsold, because, you know, you have this preconceived notion about what a comedian or what somebody who's been on Saturday Night Live and Curb Your Enthusiasm is going to sound like. But we left that conversation with him feeling so inspired, because he was talking about the same things that everybody else was talking about. And he was thinking about his craft, which is different than most of our crafts, in a very similar way that just makes sense and kind of gave us permission to look at the things we talk about, the authenticity and the optimism and the purpose, in a different way, knowing that it applies not just to salespeople, not just to marketers, but to pretty much anybody.
Oh, absolutely. So if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you guys hope it would be?
Celebrate the process. That small shift in mindset to actually look for the wins where they might not seem obvious can be a game changer for your mindset, whether you're selling or doing anything else.
Celebrate the process. That is such a great advice. And it also brings to mind yet another book that was on the show about the startup world. And at the very end of the book, the author was talking about how, you know, just focus on the activity. Do what you think needs to be done, and the other things will start to come through. Don't beat yourself up when you don't, you know, get every deal or that type of thing. Colin, what were you going
to
say?
I was going to say that there's no right way to be great at selling.
Mm.
And if you don't hold yourself to that construct, and you see yourself in the book, which we hope you do, because that's the whole point. There's so many different people. That their superpower wasn't that they were great at selling. It was that they were great at doing them. Like, that was Snoop's quote. He's like, "Why does everyone keep saying that you're the greatest salesperson on the planet, Snoop?" He's like, "I don't know. My mom told me one time, just do you and everything else will work out." And that's what we were seeing, like, including you. You know, this is the first podcast where we have had Miley Cyrus, you know, bumping in the background and and quotes from some of our favorite movies. So if you can do you better than anybody else, you probably have a good shot. And when you're not succeeding, you might be trying to be doing someone else.
Such great advice. And of course, you know, I'm the book nerd. It brings to mind another book that was on the show a few years ago by Jay Akunzo called Break the Wheel. And basically, it was a sort of a manifesto on the evils of best practices. It's saying you've got to do what works for you. And throughout the book, he's saying, you know, all these people that came up against, kind of like you at the timeshare or fractional vacation ownership, where people were saying, well, no, why do we have to be like every other one of these companies? Why does it not make sense to do something different? So yeah, very, very true. Well, let's give the listener something to do. What's one thing a listener can do today to put in action an idea from your book to get them thinking in the right direction?
I'll go first, because Garrett never lets me go first unless he gives me that pause. That's how well I know him. He finishes my sentence too. I'm going to say one thing that you can do immediately is try to figure out how you can get to a place where you want to ask a question that most people don't from anyone. Like, forget a selling situation.
Uh-huh.
Just like that, like, I dare you this weekend to ask someone a question that you really, really want to know the answer to that most people probably don't ask them. And then just sit back and see if they have the answer or if you gave them a gift.
Boy, it's funny you say that. You talk about seeing yourself in the book. I can think of I went to a baseball game last summer and I saw a friend of mine and he was asking the most interesting questions. This is a guy I've known for years. And they really got me thinking. And I look at me. I'm still talking about it. So yeah. Garrett, how about you?
Continuing on that theme, one of our favorite impactful questions is, what rules should we be breaking? And so I think one actionable takeaway, just to make a little mindset shift for people listening, is to ask yourself, what is one rule, quote, in quotes, in air quotes, what is one rule that I could be breaking? And that can potentially open up your mind for some of that creativity, for a new way of thinking about things, and for really just realizing that there is no one right way to do things. And it might open up a whole new way to approach something.
Oh, what a great idea. And what a great idea to start a meeting of whatever group it is at work. Just what's one rule we could be breaking? Hopefully it's not one they're not supposed to be breaking, but yeah. Well, Garrett, let's stay with you. Looking back, what books, aside from law books, have most inspired your working career?
Yeah, I love to dig into a good law book from time to time. No.
Well, we all have different sleep aids, Garrett.
This is such a hard question. Colin and I read a ton of books. I mean, literally at least a couple of books a month, and you can probably relate to this. You're probably even on top of what we do. But it's so hard to keep track because there are so many great ones. So I will say that Adam Grant as an author inspired us a lot.
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned him a lot in the book.
We do, and there's a reason for that. And you could see a lot of his style too, and that wasn't necessarily intentional, but as we read it, we realize that he was very influential for us just because of the way that he thinks about things. And honestly, he became a part of our journey because after the book was written and kind of in the can, and we needed to start getting blurbs and endorsements from people, we reached out to Adam. And he didn't know who we were, and he had no reason to read our book, but we were really grateful that he did. He saw something in us and in the book and gave us a really beautiful quote and recommended the book. And that's not a coincidence. That's because he is one of those people, one of those unsold. And, you know, he's out there practicing what he preaches to give more than he takes and to be transformational and not transactional. So I would say for me personally, Adam Grant's book, I always learn something interesting. His style is great. The way that he weaves logic and emotion and facts and stories is great. So it might be a cliche. Probably your sophisticated listenership is already familiar with Adam. But if you haven't read all of his books, I would say go back and check them out because they're great.
Yeah, and he's got a new one out about hidden potential.
Yeah, I loved it. Anything Malcolm Gladwell, like Adam Grant, Dan Pink. You know, one of my favorites and someone I think that even inspired me to be an author is Charles Duhigg.
Yes, and he's got a new one out too.
Yeah, I just read that, Super Communicators. Uh-huh. It's really in the spirit of the Unsold Mindset, but you know, only how Duhigg can do. It's really a great book. But The Power of Habit. I mean, listen, first of all, we share an agent, you know, with James Clear's, the author of Atomic Habits, the agent. So I can say nothing but amazing things about Atomic Habits and James Clear, but The Power of Habit for me, like it shifted the way that I thought about a lot of things. So I love Charles Duhigg. If I had to have one, I would say Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habit, or any of Charles Duhigg's.
Yeah. Well, terrific. Well, aside from, Charles Duhigg's newest book, Super Communicators, as well as Adam Grant's book, Hidden Potential, The Science of Achieving Greater Things. Are there any other recent or upcoming books you guys recommend or are looking forward to reading?
I just read Outlive. If you haven't read it, you know, you should read it. I also, I really, really like The Rich Paul autobiography, Lucky Me. That was really great. Yep. Fat Joe's autobiography is really great. If you got any hip hop heads out there, I read that recently. And then weirdly enough, Rick Rubin's The Creative Act is also like a really interesting book that you wouldn't expect someone like Rick Rubin to write. So just for a different mode, you know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. These don't have to be marketing and sales books either. Yeah. Oh, this is going to be a great list on your your episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. How about you, Garrett?
I love reading rock autobiographies.
Oh.
And so I'm always looking for the new ones. And I know it came out a few months ago, but Bono's Surrender is a new one that I've just dug into and I'm loving so far. So if anybody out there listening has any favorite rock autobiographies, that's a genre that I could never get tired of.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to keep that in mind. Yeah. Well, now you're going to be hearing from me even more. So, well, listen, that's great. And as I mentioned, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, all the books that have been mentioned, your website, ColinandGarrett.com, as well as your agency's site, your LinkedIn profiles. And now a word to you, dear listener, please reach out to Colin Garrett, ask him questions, congratulate them on the book, thank them for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if nothing else, share this interview on LinkedIn and tag us so we can personally thank you. And if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote, there's no right way to do anything, and that includes practicing an unsold mindset. Use the ideas from this book in your own way. Focus on how you're going to think rather than what you're going to say. Your thoughts will determine what being unsold means to you, but only if you're aware of them. Over time, we hope you'll try taking on all the shifts in perspectives we've introduced. They reinforce one another, and the more we've been able to inhabit the unsold mindset, the more our lives have changed because of it. The book is The Unsold Mindset, Redefining What It Means to Sell. The authors are Colin Coggins and Garrett Brown. Colin and Garrett, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Doug.